Welcome to the Nerd Party.
Hi, this is Henry Gilroy, co-executive producer of Star Wars Rebels. You're listening to Aggressive Negotiations.
Welcome to Aggressive Negotiations, that bright, shiny corner to the Star Wars galaxy that you're in search of here on the Nerd Party Network. I am one of your hosts, Jedi Master John Mills, and with me as always is the enlightened, the absolutely beatific Jedi Master, Matthew Rushing. Matt, how you doing?
Well, I'm doing beautifully, John, you know, and I can understand why you might say beatific tonight, you know, having made it to where we're recording from, which is, I don't know if the signal's actually getting out because the sensors on our ships were a little, they didn't really work as we landed on this planet. And, but I do feel as though I'm like Moses. I've seen the face of God basically, and I'm probably am glowing at this moment with all of this force energy just binding me together so solidly right now.
Yeah, that is, that's a heck of a thing to be, honestly. And we're going to get everybody there during this episode of Aggressive Negotiations. Of course, before we do that, thenerdparty.com/contact. If you want to reach out to the show, we'll get an email. You can go ahead and find us on Twitter at the Jedi Masters, where we've been championing the hashtag Star Wars Love, and you can join in the fun over there. And of course, on Twitter, you can also follow the network at Join Nerd Party, where you can go ahead and let us know what you think, not just of us, but of other shows on the network, like SETI Alpha 3, which is a Star Trek podcast, Punch It, which is a Star Trek writing podcast, Filibuster, which is our more freeform podcast, but features a lot of stuff that, including exclusives and interviews from film festivals internationally. And you can also find other terrific shows like Great Shot Kid, Nerd Nuptial, you name your fandom, and we've got something for it, even including Owlpost for Harry Potter and Time and Space for Doctor Who. Now, one other tiny bit of business before we get to this week's topic is the fact that we are having a review contest. And for the next 30 people to review and rate us on Apple Podcasts, you could win, actually, I'd call it a treasure trove of prizes, Matt. I mean, we've got a very generous listener who has provided for us these unopened, beautiful packages for this contest. Matt, do you want to tell people what they could be entering by giving us a review and rating over on Apple Podcasts?
Absolutely. Just so excited to be able to offer you this for just one simple review over there on Apple Podcasts and iTunes. First up, people could be winning in this massive prize pack, this virtual cornucopia of Star Wars goodness. We've got a trivia game, which it's really cool because this is a game that you can really play with the whole family, honestly, or just your friends. Hey, maybe, you know, you're in line at Celebration next year. You know, you could bring these cards and just have fun with each other with some trivia. We've also got the DVD, the complete third season of Star Wars Rebels, which was a great season.
Yes, it was.
Involving, you know, Thrawn and Maul. And so fantastic season there. And then last but not least coming in this prize package would be a wonderful model of the Millennium Falcon that does have to be put together, but it's a really nice model version of the Millennium Falcon from The Force Awakens from Bandai. And last but not least, something that I know that has been playing on my iTunes and in my iPhone constantly since the movie came out is the Solo soundtrack, and this is actually coming on disc. So, I mean, this prize pack is fantastic. And so, as you mentioned, John, the next 30 people who review us on iTunes will be entered to win this. Now, there will only be one winner. This is a huge prize package. Thank you so much to our listener, Chris, for providing all of these. I mean, honestly, huge thank you. He contacted us and let us know he had these items and wanted to help out the show. it blew us away. And we're just excited, honestly, to be able to give it to one of you lucky 30 people. So again, go over there to iTunes or Apple Podcasts, whichever name you enjoy. Give us a star rating and review. We will be keeping track, and then we will do a drawing for the winner. And then you will get this amazing prize package of Star Wars goodness.
And if you want to see a picture of this prize package, you can actually go to the aforementioned Twitter handle at the Jedi Masters, and you will see all of these things on display. And I got to tell you, I kind of wish I could enter said contest, but I have a feeling that that's a violation of the spirit of the rules in some way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I have a feeling that way about the model. I want the model.
My Jedi insights tell me that I'm not supposed to do that. Okay, great.
I think they consider that a Sith move.
Speaking of Jedi and Sith, that brings us to this week's topic. Now, a bit of reaction has been had online to the fact that a little tiny tidbit about what Lucas foresaw as some of the stuff he would have explored in the sequel trilogy had he stayed on to do it, the path that he would have gone down with it, and things that he would have explored. And what's interesting about that is there were some snap reactions. This is the internet age. Of course, everybody had instantaneous reactions to things.
Oh, everybody had the hot takes.
Everybody had the hot takes. But as you and I read it, something that came somewhat clear to us was that this was territory that had been broached before in the Clone Wars. It was later picked up again, actually, in Rebels as well. The Clone Wars is our initial beachhead there. And, of course, people point to the Mortis arc, which is phenomenal. It's a wonderful three-episode arc that the both of us have talked about here on the podcast before. There's an expansive arc in the sixth season of the Clone Wars, which is, of course, accessible still on Netflix. And it kicks off story-wise with them getting on the trail and figuring out what happened with Sifo Dyas and how he was connected to everything that kicked off the Clone War. I actually remember the first time seeing Plo Koon with the troopers arrive at the ship on, you know, during the storm and lifting up that saber that had the dust falling off of it and saying, you know, and igniting it and, you know, oh my gosh, we're going to find out what the deal was with Sifo Dyas. More details on that. It then moved into an arc much more focused on Yoda. There was three episodes, Voices, Visions, and Sacrifice. And I think this whole arc, but especially those episodes, very much give an indication of where his head was going to be for the sequel trilogy. And I think it ties into what he said before. So I'm presuming you agree with that, Matt, but given that, seeing that little bit, do you think that this arc was our first taste of where he was going to go next?
I absolutely do. Just a quick tidbit, because this is something I found so interesting while watching the entire arc, was that Yoda has this experience that starts with hearing Qui-Gon. And all of that comes about, though, because they begin to unravel the web of the Dark Lord of the Sith.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought that that was interesting. It's almost as if the Force was allowing the Jedi to be able to see where they had basically screwed up. And then allow some of them, obviously Yoda, and then of course Obi-Wan Kenobi, very important, is going to play into this whole idea, to begin to make the transition that it's there will not be victory in the Clone Wars, but as Yoda says at the very end of this, not victory in the Clone Wars, but victory for all time.
Right.
The goal here is beyond that, that there will finally be balance, there will finally be peace. So I thought that was really fascinating. But back to the question, I absolutely 100% believe that, especially in light of reading some things that George had even said previously before this would have been something that would have been a part of the storyline. And so I think... he definitely planted the seeds here. But even beyond that, I think when I look at this arc, it does such a great job of finally expanding and explaining a part of his thought process from The Phantom Menace that he wasn't able to pick up on in the films, because he just doesn't... The storyline is focused on the Skywalkers, you know, and the
right.
series really gives him the opportunity to then be able to expand on his mythology. And when we look at how deep it gets, I think it's just fascinating when you get into especially those last three episodes and what we're talking about.
And I think that there's also very much a very clear indication that he was, if you study his evolution, he goes, you know, like any artist, he goes through phases. And what I find most intriguing is when you get to these three episodes in specific, you see much more an embrace of his basic roots. Now, again, this is not to take away from the fact that Christian Taylor was a writer, that there were directors that worked on it, those sorts of things, that there were people who were helping bring this to the screen. So when we say, you know, Lucas's vision, we're not saying anything in any way that diminishes the contributions that all of these people made, you know, to this arc or to any of the other arcs. But there is very much a more abstract exploration of things in this arc. You actually see the series move toward this. And so I think that if you look at the chronological release dates of, you know, of all of the series, if you go back to the originals and then you go to the prequels and then you go to where the Clone Wars was headed when the plug was pulled on it, you see this maturation where he becomes more comfortable being the guy who did THX-1138 peeking through again.
Right.
I see a lot of that coming through.
Well, and what's so interesting here is that, you know, again, just to go back for a second, I mean, this whole arc starts with them unraveling these things, mm-hmm. Which is so fascinating. We get to see Valorum again. You know, we get to see the power of the crime syndicates and what they hold over the universe, which will play into what we see in Solo now.
Yes.
You know, yeah. So there's a lot of things. And we know George had a conversation with Kasdan before they sold. So that was in his mindset, this idea of you know, maybe doing other film.
And, you know, a quote jumps out, actually, from Yoda in this arc of the danger is not to know the truth. And I think that in and of itself is so interesting, because some of the reaction to the stuff that got leaked is somewhat disappointing. You know, it's the typical sort of online vitriol of, oh, thank God Disney bought it. Oh, geez, I wouldn't have wanted it. And he even acknowledges in the excerpt, he's like, hey, a lot of people probably would have hated this, but this is what I would have done, sort of thing. But getting back to the arc itself, before we get into the really deep dive stuff, because this really is sort of like next level mind blowing sorts of concepts, mm-hmm. R2.
Yeah.
Some people find R2's inclusion in so many things to be, to use a popular term, problematic, if you will. Do you find R2's inclusion in this specific arc to be one of those instances?
No. Actually, I champion R2 being a part of all of these things because I love it, because the thought process that R2 is the one who knows the most about the Star Wars galaxy is incredible, and nobody utilizes him as a resource, ever. Like,
right.
You know, like, R2 literally knows more than anybody else about the entire Star Wars galaxy from the time of the prequels all the way to the sequel trilogy.
Yeah.
Nobody ever asks R2 what he thinks.
And that's the thing, is people have postulated on occasion, well, R2's a jerk because he doesn't say these things. I think R2's personality is such, and it's not being a jerk, but we all know people like this where it is simply their default personality setting, where if this were to come up in a conversation, like I could see a time period between, you know, Empire and Jedi where Luke is like, man, Dagobah, could you imagine ever going there? And R2 saying something like, oh yeah, before you were born, I was there. What? Why didn't you say something? You didn't ask. And he's not doing it to be spiteful. Yep. He's just like, you didn't ask me. You didn't say, have you been here before? I could have helped you out.
look, as much trash as some of the EU got from certain people, you know, at least once the prequels started coming out, they realized that R2 was a resource and they started using him like that, you know, to tell people stories that they'd missed, you know, like finding out about Padme and stuff. Like, that's how Luke and Leia got to see their mother, because R2 had a recording and stuff like that, you know. So it's like, at least it makes sense, you know, like they're actually utilizing what they have. So I personally, and the fact that Anakin sends R2 with Yoda, I think it's just, it's a really cute moment. Like, Anakin trusts R2-D2 with his life, and now he's trusting the life of Yoda with R2-D2 as well. And just at a more shallow level, the relationship between Anakin and Yoda here was really fun.
Yes.
Because Yoda is very much his champion, because he needs his spontaneity. He needs his ability to be able to think outside the box. And the thing that most other Jedi have a little bit harder time doing. And Anakin being able to say, hey, for once, this was not my idea. You know,
yeah,
it was awesome.
You know, and something that is also very interesting to me is... something that we see come into play is the tree. Mm-hmm. And the fact that the tree comes back in The Last Jedi, you know, for better or worse, you know, however you feel about it, the tree reflects, you know, the temple. And the tree was also brought up in Shattered Empire, where there were two trees that the Emperor had. And they were very, very much tied to the Force. And so trees become a very constant thing. And I think a Tolkien-esque thread through all of this, all of this mythology. But I want to ask you, did you have any point? Because I can point to a certain point in this arc where even now, rewatching it again and again, where I stop and I say, yeah, wow, this is weird. This is not, you know, it's not what I expected. Did you have any moment like that where you just sort of had to take stock in your brain of this is, I never expected this to go in this direction?
You know what? I think I, even rewatching it now, that still happens, just because it's so esoteric for a kid's cartoon show to be doing this in the first place. I mean, when Yoda is fighting his golem self, you know, and talking about the philosophy behind all of that with the Force priestesses and everything is totally next level stuff. I mean, this is philosophy like 305 in grad school, you know, kind of thing. Like, this is crazy. But the thing that really stood out to me the most was I've rewatched this now because I did my rewatch of the Clone Wars series and I just had finished it not too long ago. So I went back and then watched it again. And one of the things that really struck me that was just kind of, lower level thing, but I was like, huh, this is actually the first instance we see of a Force being from beyond interacting with the real world from the nether world of the Force. Because Qui-Gon interacts with Yoda. He picks him up with the Force. He, he blows out the candle. He ruffles the furniture. I mean... very clear that the ability to interact with and have an impact on the physical world, even though Qui-Gon cannot become corporeal in the sense of you can't see him, he still has a lot of power over the universe. And I thought that was really fascinating and something that was very reminiscent of what, you know, Lucas had an idea of with Obi-Wan coming back in Return of the Jedi and possibly helping out with the fight against Darth Vader.
Yeah, that is a really interesting, and the reasons they discarded that I think were good, but it is obviously something that's sort of like, you know, had a seed in there. Every time I watch the arc, something I think of is, if only Qui-Gon had been able to talk to Yoda like this a little bit earlier. Because, of course, you hear his voice calling out for Anakin in Attack of the Clones.
Right.
But it is sort of like a point of confusion for Yoda.
Mm-hmm.
And actually, the novelization actually says, Yoda says that talking from beyond the grave isn't possible. You lose your identity. Right. Then you, but then you have this echo of that in this arc, because when Anakin is walking into the same, we'll call it the garden at the temple where the tree is, Anakin hears Qui-Gon. So that is another, I think, indication of how strong, what a connection Anakin has with the Force as a baseline. But he's
isn't that an indication, though, that it feels like the experience on Mortis has had ripple effects as well? And maybe that's why, because Qui-Gon showed up there, that's a Yoda-specific question. You know, your experience on Mortis, you talked to Qui-Gon Jinn. Do you think that was, they have that whole thing. So do you think maybe that had the ability to make Qui-Gon, or is he just waiting for the right moment at this point?
I see it more as the fact that Anakin is able to hear, Anakin is so tied in. Does it have something to do with Mortis? Well, then why wouldn't Obi-Wan have heard it? Because Obi-Wan had a conversation with him as well.
Right, but you remember in the episode, Obi-Wan says that he felt like it was a manifestation of their memories of Qui-Gon. It doesn't believe it to be the real Qui-Gon.
Right, so, and Anakin repeats that, but Anakin actually through this is the only one who says, basically, this isn't possible based on what we know. He's the only one who's open to the idea. So I think that in and of itself, a lot of this arc has to do with faith and acceptance and letting go. And I think it's interesting that Anakin is the one who is open to the possibility. But you also, you could also extrapolate that as you see the seed already there of Anakin, the weakness that Palpatine is going to be able to exploit. Because the other Jedi are at peace. It's like, yeah, you're going to die. You're going to become one with the Force, whatever. And Anakin is the one that's open. Is like, well, hey, maybe, guys, maybe we can do this. That was interesting.
Well, and what you see is that Anakin becomes the person who's after the same thing that the Sith are in the end, which is the rejection of the fact that life passing into death is not the end, basically, right? And all of that wrapped up into that, whereas, the Jedi and like you said, are at peace with the fact that they will become one with the Force. And I thought that was really interesting, because you really see that play out, because obviously that is, when we go to Moribond, we kind of see that's what the Sith were after, was this idea of being able to live forever as they are now, whereas it's the Jedi's. And even specifically, we see Qui-Gon, who was searching for something deeper in the Force than anybody else had. And he's the first one of the Jedi, or at least the first Jedi that we know of, because the priestesses say this is a gift that's not been given to many.
The thing is, that plays into, yes, you're right. I remember there's a specific quote where when Yoda rejects, the quote unquote memory or spirit of Darth Bane, voiced by Mark Hamill, no less.
Which was great.
Yeah, it is, isn't it? Where he says specifically the Sith are obsessed with the physical reality.
Mm-hmm.
They're obsessed with the physical world. And I think that in and of itself has an interesting bounce off, where the idea of balance is combining everything. The Jedi are obsessed with, letting go and searching the higher truth. The Sith are obsessed with the physical realm. And you could sit down and have the philosophical conversation of where between those two poles do you meet to find that balance? Are you closer to one than the other? Does one not exist? Do you have to combine aspects of them? And, you can sit there and debate that. And in terms of, I'm glad you brought up the fact that the priestesses, if you will, said that very few have been given the gift, because it's kind of mind-blowing that Yoda's having this, and there's nothing in the archives. There's nothing that, Jocasta knew can say, oh, yeah, no, there's a recorded story from, 500 years ago. I mean, Yoda's been alive for 1,000 years, so if anybody should know one of these stories, it would be him. Don't you find it so fascinating? I find it fascinating that everybody considers it such a strange thing that there's never been a recorded instance that somebody can say, no, you know, I remember reading about that.
My feeling was is that just as Qui-Gon hadn't mentioned it to anybody, anybody who had been searching for this gift, you know, I mean, it's almost as if it's the person who is really searching out the Force and maybe the Journal of the Wills type of thing, right? You know, like really searching into the nitty-gritty, the deepest levels, and opening themselves up to those type of ideas, not dangerous ideas like Sith type ideas, but that there is more than just the dogmatic views of the Jedi, and Qui-Gon's definitely the person to do that. What I love here, though, is that Yoda specifically has, they tell him, you have been chosen. And Qui-Gon says, you have been chosen as I was before you. And Yoda says, chosen am I? And he says, you will learn to preserve your life force so that you can manifest a consciousness that will allow you to communicate with the living after death. And he says, how? And then Qui-Gon says, dark times are ahead and the forces of light must remain. This is so awesome because what it's saying is that the Force itself has a will and a way to make sure that light persists even when the darkness is coming. And that Yoda is chosen to make sure that that light remains. And what I thought was so fascinating is that it's so beautiful that Qui-Gon was also one that was chosen, and it's because he was open enough. And I think that's pretty cool because it lets you know just how amazing Qui-Gon is. Yoda's lived for 1,000 years, and he's just now getting this gift. Qui-Gon was what, like 50s?
60. He was,
you know,
60.
60s. Yeah. You know, so like it just lets you know, like, and I like, now I want that story. I want that book about Qui-Gon. Yep. I seriously, like, this needs to be a book.
And keep in mind also that specifically the priestess says he is to teach one who will bring balance. So they specifically cite, because and back when my blog was still up and running and everything, I had that, remember that whole series I had? It was like I was presenting cases for each person as the chosen one in the story up to that point. And, you know, arguments pro and con. This is the strongest argument that goes to something that I've held on to as sort of like a headcanon theory, is that Anakin was the chosen one. Yes. Anakin came along, wrong choices were made. And so the Force said, well, we're going to need another chosen one. So he's going to have a kid, or we're going to conceive the kid some way, and that's going to be our do-over. And I think that this is the indication here that Anakin's failure, which is already manifest, I would argue, the Force, the will of the Force, has something in place for Luke to come about. And they say flat out, he is to teach one who will bring balance. And I think that's very cool.
Yeah. Okay, so I want to throw something at you because I took this a little bit differently in light of the idea that Lucas was thinking about a third trilogy, and in light of the fact that what Qui-Gon tells Yoda is that he's been chosen so that he can communicate after death. And the whole idea then would be that becoming a Force ghost is a big idea. Let me get this through your head, Star Wars fans. They're meant to be used. They're meant to be there to like Lucas is clearly saying in this series, this arc. I'm getting really animated. I'm sorry, but he is so much saying that Force ghosts are meant to be important players on the chessboard of Star Wars, even after they died, because this is the point of this. This is the point of this gift, is to make sure that light persists. So in that, when the Force priestess says, he is to teach one that will save the universe from a great imbalance. For this, the great gift will be his. I took that as it could be Luke, but it could also be that this great gift will also be needed later on down the road. And that's where that third trilogy comes in, where Obi-Wan and Yoda will be people who will be needed then to help another great imbalance. And so, like, I agree with you that I think this is something that I could take as complete confirmation that it is Luke who is really the one who will create, you know, the peace after this great imbalance. But at the same time, I could see how Lucas was also setting himself to be able to have that third trilogy.
Well, yeah, I mean, you also hear there is another Skywalker. One of them says there is another Skywalker as an echo when the vision ends. I don't discount that. I don't discount what you're saying. You and I go back and forth consistently about exactly how much influence the Force Ghosts will have. And I think that's something that also comes into play. Obviously, Last Jedi ran with that and Yoda popped up. Why he waited that long to pop up, that becomes the point of debate. Why did he wait 30 years between, so far as we know? Maybe he showed up sometime between the movies and we just don't know that story yet. Also completely possible. But in terms of them showing up, I know that one of the reasons Obi-Wan didn't show up in Return of the Jedi was because they wanted it to be Luke's victory. There was debate about whether it would take agency away from Luke.
Mm-hmm.
But I think there totally would be a place for however long or anything like that for those Force Ghosts to show up. I completely agree with you that they could help Luke along in terms of, I think maybe that's one of the things that we're both sort of hinging on there, where it's like these ghosts could have communicated with Luke to help him toward the next steps of what he would have to accomplish.
Well, and I also think too, this is like why Luke should come back then in Episode 9. You know, I mean, to me, this fits the mold of why he should be back in the same way that, you know, Obi-Wan was back in Return of the Jedi as a ghost and Yoda came back as a ghost as well to have the conversation. So, you know, this is what I think is so important. And again, I think it's very clear that this gift is meant to be given so that these ghosts can have an impact. That's the whole point of the gift. Like, otherwise, it's not just like, hey, you did a good job, kid, so we're going to make you a Force ghost. No, there's a reason for that. But one of the things that I found really fascinating here is the conversation that we get around midichlorians.
Mm-hmm.
And that the planet that they go to is actually the foundation of life for the universe, the birthplace of what science calls the midichlorians, that connects the living force with the cosmic force. And that the living force is from all things who have ever lived, which feeds into the cosmic force. And those two kind of have a symbiont circle that
continually they replenish each other.
Yeah. 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 And so I just, the whole idea that we were, you know, everybody complained that Lucas made the force science, right? But the idea, like you were saying, that science was trying to explain something that was so unexplainable. And watching these arcs, you're just like, with your brain, you know?
Right. I mean, the thing is, finding a mechanism to explain why some people would have more of a connection to this cosmic force than the other, why there would be a difference between a living being and an inanimate object and those sorts of things, it actually makes, I mean, when you think about it, complete sense in a storytelling way. How are you going to tell why can Luke be a Jedi? Why can Rey do her thing and Poe can't or Han can't? And so I think that probably what it was, and we've talked about it before, midichlorians in a sense, I think on a base level, there's some initial subconscious rejection of it because it puts in your mind, well, maybe I couldn't be a Jedi. Whereas some of the fun of being a kid was always anybody can be a, we're all Jedi, you know, and it's that sort of thing. But all of that aside, I think that it's also a very, because we know that Lucas is very influenced by, Eastern religions and those sorts of things. There's very much, when you go to that wellspring in Visions, it's very much sort of a Buddhist expression, if you will, a Buddhist type expression of this idea that energy wanted to taste matter, and so became the reality that we experience. Like, the energy was always there, and then it found a way in and became reality. And I've just never had a problem with it. And I think that that probably is something where if somebody were uninitiated or somebody is just wholeheartedly against the whole concept of the midichlorians to begin with, I think that this arc winds up being difficult for them. And I think maybe that's the resonant frequency where people read those snippets and say, you know, and reject it out of hand and say, oh, thank goodness it didn't go down that road. But the thing is, everything that this opens up is so far beyond. And when you see this arc of going to, you know, number one, going to the wellspring of all life in the universe, it's basically the Garden of Eden. And also while there, going again to another tree that's enshrouded in a storm and encountering an evil Yoda. I mean, that's something that in and of itself is completely bonkers. Nobody would ever I wouldn't think, oh, there's an evil Yoda out there. And he has to face and confront it himself. Mm-hmm. And it's one of those things where it's so full of symbolism and meaning. And at the same time, I think something that's fun to ponder, because we're talking about the Force ghosts and the priestesses and Qui-Gon, is if you'll notice, nobody ever gives a straight answer. Qui-Gon says, you know, I can't tell it to you, but I'll show you where to go. And the priestesses are constantly giving riddle answers to Yoda, because everything is about setting somebody on a path of enlightenment. They have to earn this next stage of existence. It's never just given to them. They're chosen to be tested to see if they can earn that. And Yoda's test, I think a very fascinating echo of it is in that Vader comic that we talked about, where Vader is tested by the Kyber crystal, shown this possibility of another future if he turns his back on the dark side. And Yoda instead is tempted with this vision, and it actually reminded me very much of the film The Last Temptation of Christ, where the whole thing of that is, you know, the temptation shown is that Christ is shown this life where he's taken down from the cross and he just goes off and lives a normal life and is happy and has a family and everything like that. And at the end of it, a Judas comes in and says, no, this isn't the way it's supposed to be. What are you doing? This isn't the way it's supposed to be. And he goes and he accepts the gift. And I see sort of an echo in that with Yoda's temptation, is he's shown Qui-Gon's alive. Dooku never left. There's no war. Everybody's happy. Come on over here to the garden with us. We're all happy. And it's Yoda who stops and says, no, this isn't right. This isn't how it's supposed to be. You're dead. You died over there. There's a war going on. What are you talking about? So even though Yoda is preparing himself for the idea of going to this next stage of existence, there's no rejection of reality. And I think that's key.
Yeah. And I think what it is too, which is really beautiful, is there's an objective truth. You know, Yoda knows there's an objective truth, which is, mm-hmm. No, the way things are is this, not what you're showing me.
Right.
Life is not a dream, you know, and so the beauty in that is him figuring that out. And the other thing I thought was really fascinating, and I think is such a great lesson that he learns, and I was even thinking about this personally, of, you know, saying, I give you no power to my dark side, instead of accepting that it's there, because it's through the non-acceptance that you actually give it power over you. You accept that it's there, but as Yoda said, but through training and discipline, I master you. And mm-hmm. that it is a work that we must all do to face our dark side, see what it is, look it in the face and say, yeah, you're ugly and nasty, but I refuse to allow you to be the one that controls me. I will control you. And I thought that was a really, really neat, powerful lesson. And like when you're talking about the messages, morals, and meanings of, you know, like Star Wars and what George is going through, I think that's really powerful.
Naturally, I agree, and I think it can't be overstated, because the tendency in modern storytelling is, oh, I have a dark side, and I'm going to accept it, and it's a part of me. And Yoda accepts that it exists, but like you said, he says, but you don't have dominion here. I know that you exist. Get out. And I think that it's also worth pointing out that they specifically cite him conquering his hubris in that moment, because Yoda is the one in Attack of the Clones that talks about how prideful the Jedi have become. And it's the conquering of pride. And the quote that I really love is, you must know yourself, your true self, and let it go. It is all about this idea of accepting. And when you get to Morband, the great fear of the Sith that they try to put inside him is, you'll mean nothing. You will mean nothing. But at the same time, Yoda means something, because he specifically says, I know myself, and I'm okay with what that means. And if I mean nothing, so be it. There's not this fear of what your meaning is. And I think that's an important lesson too.
The thing about this arc, I think, that's so amazing is, one, obviously George kind of starting us down the path to talk about the foundations of the Star Wars galaxy, you know, from the smallest level to, you know, beings, right? And I think that it's beautiful, the whole idea of Yoda being chosen, but at the same time, he has a part in it. You know, like, it reminds me of the scripture, you know, work out your salvation with fear and trembling. And in some ways, that's what Yoda is doing. He has the faith, right? But he is then working it out, allowing himself to be refined. And that's what this process is a refining of Yoda. And what I loved, what you're saying earlier, is that this is a conquering of his hubris, which when he got there, he did not really believe himself to be one who needed to be taught. He's a Jedi Master. He even says that, you know, when she talks about how, you know, the Force connects them all, you know, and one thing passes to another. Yoda even says, well, I already know that. And it's very funny to me and it's very interesting to watch him go from being somebody who feels like he knows it all to realizing he kind of is back at the beginning, which is where he gets the phrase, you must unlearn what you have learned.
Great point.
And I think that's the thing that I really like, is that this arc also does wonders for the idea of Yoda, because he will continue to try on the path of the Clone Wars, but he doesn't necessarily feel like there might be victory there, but it sets him up to be the character that you'll know in Empire. And there's even a little bit of that when he is playing around with Anakin and escaping. That crazy Yoda is kind of there, you know, and he's his mischievousness, his goofiness, all of those things that we kind of love about Empire Yoda are slowly starting to emerge. And I think what the arc really does is create one of the greatest storytelling opportunities that Lucas had. You know, I mean, the Clone Wars is done, it's over, and we're not getting any more. And so the fact that this is how we go out, I think, is really neat. That Lucas finally gets to kind of give us his last treatise on what it means to be in the Star Wars galaxy with the Force, why somebody like Yoda is so important, why somebody, you know. And the what I think is really fascinating too is that, I mean, just think, this gift will be passed on. It will be passed on to Obi-Wan. So he is one of those special people, which I think is, when you in light of this, that's a really neat, I mean, that's awesome. And then somehow, I mean, Anakin gets the same, like, you kind of like, you know, I think, I don't know, it just...
Well, that's of course the big debate, isn't it? Yeah. How did Anakin and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And we won't open that can of worms this time. you know, but I think that the more we talk about this, the more convinced I become as well that Luke's got to come back in episode 9.
If he doesn't, I feel like I want to riot at that point.
Well, because it wouldn't, in a very real sense, it just makes sense for Luke to have learned this skill. He would have had to willfully turn his back on learning this skill. Now, again, we still don't know anything that was going on in Octo. Octo? Is that it?
Octo.
I'm going to say Octo because it was episode 8. I think it's a play on Octo, like the, you know, for 8. Anyway, we don't know what was going on there or anything like that. But, you know, I think
there's also 30 years. So
that's true. I think that there's also an opportunity to maybe take this arc and then you go forward and you see some of the stuff explored in Rebels. And when you get to Luke, maybe his failing, you know, everybody loves to debate what's his failing that leads to this and that. Maybe his initial failing is that he becomes too convinced in the role of the physical realm in what's happening, that he, for whatever reason, sees the physical realm as more important than it is, because this whole arc is about Yoda realizing, I mean, the Clone War is going on, for Pete's sake, and it's even acknowledged by Qui-Gon as feeding the dark side of the Force. And at the end of this journey, Yoda basically just shrugs and says, yeah, we're playing the long game, though. Yeah, this sucks, but I figured out how we're going to win the long game. And that is, in and of itself, you know, a release of the physical realm. And so, I don't know. I think that there are always ways to go back to arcs like this and find ways to work with plot lines or threads and fit them in. Every fan does it. Every fan can do it. But what I wanted to ask you was, with the magic tree on Dagobah, we've gotten a couple of different stories, and this arc doesn't contradict any of them. Do you think that within that tree, again a tree, do you think that that was a temple under there? What do you think that place was? Because there are very clearly steps and an archway. We saw the archway in Empire Strikes Back. So we know there was a building of some sort on Dagobah. Do you think it's an old Jedi temple? Or do you think that it is a... I know that in one of Zahn's books, actually, it was said that somebody had found Yoda and there was a Force battle there. So what do you think the origin of that little under tree room is?
Yoda says in Empire that strong with the dark side is that place.
Mm-hmm.
So I wonder if it was some sort of Sith temple at one time, or Sith structure. That, to me, makes a little bit of sense.
What if it was a Jedi temple that the Sith destroyed?
Could have been that, too. Yeah.
And that's why it got consumed by the dark side.
I loved that it was included here, and I thought it was really neat to have Yoda walk in and kind of experience his greatest fear, you know, the same way that Luke does. It's really nice mirroring and that beautiful tome poem, you know, where you see that. And it makes so much more sense now why Yoda talks to Luke the way he does about that. You know, your weapons, you will not need them, you know, and... because the same thing happened to him. And so, I thought it was sad for him because, too, he does literally watch what's going to happen before his eyes. He watches all of his friends die. You know, he sees Mace get thrown out the window by Sidious. You know, he knows what's going to go down now. At least a version of what could possibly happen.
Right, he knows what the possible future is.
He's seeing a lot of what's actually going to happen.
But because in the vision that he has later, he sees Mace dead in the temple and Ahsoka next to him.
Right.
Which is, you know, of course, a pretty amazing moment to see Ahsoka there.
Yeah, because last time we saw her in the Clone Wars.
Yeah, at that point, we thought that was the last time we were going to see her. So, spoilers for Rebels on that one. But I think that the most intriguing thing about this arc is the fact that the exploration of things, it really just solidifies how far beyond the straightforward story things were ready to go. And before anybody thinks that I'm throwing shade on anything, I'm just saying that this is something where the deep part of me that loves certain things for the fact that it makes me sit down and question and think about and challenge, did I really understand what was happening? I mean, like you said, it's like philosophy 305. It's like I've sat through class and I'm like, I got this. I've taken the requisites. I got no problem with this. And then I get a couple of lectures and I walk out holding my head in my hand saying, I didn't understand anything before this. This is, you know, and this is something where I really think, I mean, I doubt anybody listening to this has not watched this arc at this point. But if you haven't, if somebody hasn't, how would you sell somebody on watching this arc? How would you sell it to somebody who hasn't watched The Clone Wars? How would you sell this arc to them?
I think that this is the boldest, most unique, off the wall, outside of the box Star Wars storytelling that we ever got next to the Mortis arc. Like, this takes that and just ratchets that up, you know, times 100. And, you know, the whole idea of talking about, you know, storytelling that is different and bold and fresh and new and exciting and all the... I mean, this is just completely 100% unexpected. It's hard to oversell how amazing this is, you know, like, it just...
Yeah,
I can't oversell it. This is an incredible arc of the Clone Wars, and it's also an incredible Star Wars storytelling. Like, if you watch all four of these together, this is an amazing Star Wars movie that just blows your mind in every single way possible with ideas and thoughts and like depth and I keep coming back. It's just so bold. It's so bold.
Yes. And I think that bold is the perfect word for it. I mean, there are so many, just to add on to what you said, there are so many little things that are confirmations, reinforcements, or spins on things that we've encountered up to this point. Yoda wanting to leave the temple and Anakin saying, "You're not a prisoner." And Yoda saying, "Am I not?" And looking up, and you see the guards standing there at the door. And if you really look at the lighting in that room and in the temple, it's so much darker. It's so much starker. It doesn't look right or peaceful anymore. And Yoda even says, "Already around us, the cage may be." And I think that you have a lot of things in this that are, like you said, next level. There are transitions. When Yoda comes out of his near-death experience of talking to Qui-Gon, and it spins out, and then it transitions over, and he's coughing the water out of his lungs, and Obi-Wan's over him. Like, just that, it's an amazing moment. Like, you watch an animated film, or you watch an animated series, and you think, oh, that's cool, that's neat. This is some next level, like, film editing that's happening in this art. Even if you turn off the sound and just watch it, there is just stuff where you're just blown away by the way certain transitions happen.
I was thinking about that with the editing of the fight between him and Dark Yoda.
Oh my gosh,
the fight scene there, the way that it's edited looks like any amazing film would be edited. The quick cutting between it, the shot selection, everything like that, what they're doing there is pretty amazing. And so you're saying that about the Jedi and them kind of losing their way. What I kind of love, again, about the very beginning of this whole arc, which is, it seems disconnected, but it's not, the whole Sifo-Dyas thing. We learn specifically in that arc that the Jedi were already losing themselves by the time of Valorum. I mean, this episode shows you how the Jedi had lost control of their own order when the Chancellor could involve the Jedi in a secret mission that the Council knew nothing about.
Right.
I mean,
the danger of too many layers of bureaucracy, the danger of a lack of transparency in government, the danger of anybody having an agenda and knowing how to hide it. Yeah, you're spot on with that. Absolutely spot on.
It kind of blew my mind. I was like, oh my gosh, you know, and Yoda is shocked by this because he says the council knew nothing of this. And the idea that the council could not know something about its own order does not sit well with him. And I think the whole idea of just, I was just like, wow, okay, we really are seeing why the Jedi lost themselves.
Or even an echo of that in the fact that when, if you go back and tie it into Attack of the Clones, when Obi-Wan is like, oh, wasn't he killed 10 years ago? And it's obvious in that moment that Yoda and Mace know something they haven't even told Obi-Wan. And he's part of their little inner circle. And so there's something even Obi-Wan doesn't know at that point, and how secretive even the Jedi have become. And this arc specifically talks about that, where there's, you know, division and distrust within the Jedi ranks themselves. And the disbelief even. I do love, you're much more the Obi-Wan fan than I am. Not to say I'm not a fan. I love Obi-Wan. But the fact that Ki-Adi-Mundi is willing to say, hey, Yoda might be being manipulated by the dark side of the Force. And Obi-Wan's the one that turns and looks at him and says, whoa, hey, slow down there, champ. You know, like, this is Yoda we're talking about. But even Yoda is willing to admit, no, even I'm capable of being manipulated. And that's why he's willing to undergo all of these tests. I just think it's so fascinating how intricate and how realized the world building is. I think for all of the other stuff that we've talked about, this arc really crystallizes exactly how dense and how intricate all of the world building has been up to this point. And the fact that you can be a Star Wars fan for decades and watch this arc and feel like you're just learning something new. This is something you've never seen before in Star Wars. That's really kind of amazing.
The thing that sets this apart is you can see the masterstroke of how well Lucas understands his universe, how well he's able to pass that on to Christian Taylor and Dave Filoni and allow them to run with the story. And I think that's the beautiful thing that I enjoy about the show and specifically Clone Wars. You mentioned something earlier that I thought was really interesting. And one of the things that I thought was so beautiful about this was also the fact that just the show itself, the distance the animation has gone by the time you get to this point, I mean, is amazing. Because anytime I watched this part of the Clone Wars and then I go back to the movie or, you know, you're just, it's astounding how far they came with the animation. And you know, look, obviously we love this show, but the love that was poured into it through everybody who worked on it, from George to Dave to the writers to the editors to the lighters to the, you know, they poured their heart and soul into making something that I think is very unique and very special. And to have gone out again with a story like this, does it get any better? I don't think so.
I'm going to say that my final note, I agree with you. This is one of those things where it's tough to watch this arc because I will always pine for what it showed was possible and how much I want more of it. And how much it appealed to me and why certain things that were included in Solo made me so happy because it acknowledged this, which is such an important work. And even down to the very super tiny details of things like when Yoda has his vision of the dark times coming and we finally get to see Shaak-Ti killed on screen.
Yes.
Which
yes.
may seem funny to somebody to call out, but it for anybody who knows the history of how many times they tried to kill her on screen mm-hmm. and you didn't get to yep. see it, and you don't even get to see who does it. So you can still sit there and say, maybe it was Grievous. Who knows? It's just such a beautiful sort of thing because even that is a reference within itself to be like, hey, longtime fans, we know. We'll give it to you finally. Here it is. I think that in and of itself was really wonderful.
Yeah, absolutely. John, if anybody wanted to get the opportunity to catch up with you and talk more about this, I think this is a topic that is rife for conversation with the amount of material that is covered here by Lucas and the writers and the creators of the Clone Wars. Where can people catch up with you?
Well, I'll be the first to admit that any read of this arc is a valid read because I think that's one of the most beautiful things about it. I will never, ever dig in my heels and say, no, the way I'm looking at it is right. And that's why probably one of the reasons I love it most is that I can watch this and say, this is what I think, but I'm totally open to somebody else's interpretation. There's nothing set in stone about this. And if you want to discuss it with me, I'm at Kessel Junkie. Typically on Twitter. You can also find me right here on the network, co-hosting Great Shot Kid with Mike Schindler, where we talk about the inner workings and behind the scenes parts of movies, TV shows, and other entertainment that you love. We dig into it. And you can find me co-hosting Words with Nerds with my pal Craig. And, outside of that, really just harassing Matt online. And so, Matt, where else can people find you when I'm asleep and not harassing you?
It's true. You can find me ducking John over on Twitter at MattRushing02, as well as on Instagram. You can also find me here on the network talking about Harry Potter with Drea Kaufman and Owlpost, walking through each and every chapter of the series. It's a super fun show. And then I'm over on the Track FM network talking about Star Trek Deep Space Nine with Chris Jones over on The Orb. I also do our General Geek show, which is called the 602 Club, and we get a chance to cover all of the fandoms we love, which is so much fun. John actually joined me over there not too long ago to talk about Solo's lead-in novel, Most Wanted, which was a great conversation. I hope you'll check that out. And then last but not least, I do a show with my friend Courtney where we talk about film through the lens of faith, and that you can find, it's called Cinema Stories. And last but not least, I wanted to mention, I don't normally mention this, but I've been doing a lot more with it recently. I do have a blog, and I've been doing some reviews of Star Wars books and that kind of stuff, so if you're interested in that, you can check that at 42lifeinbetween.wordpress.com. But John, with all that said, I think there's only one thing left to say. I think it's time to close negotiations.
Matt, negotiations are closed.
Join the revolution. Join the Nerd Party.